if you ever read Catcher in the Rye, you know it's loaded with conspiracies going back to the 1950s. And today, in part two, we're going to unpack a lot of those conspiracies. And I'm going to shed light on some very, very dark ideas. So if you haven't listened to part one, I walked you through the whole book and the whole story and kind of alluded to various ideas about what we're going to talk about today, where we wrap up our conversation of Catcher in the Rye. We're going to discuss the creation of the book, controversies. We'll find out more about the author, J.D. Salinger's, his PTSD from going to war, pedo claims, his Eastern Orthodox spirituality. We're going to revisit Ryderly and Jay Widener's Kubrick's Odyssey 3. We're talking about July 16th again, synchronicities, Mark David Chapman's Alien War, Joe Atwill's Freemasonry and the Rye Conspiracy, connections to the movie The Game, and all kinds of fun stuff. We got more explicit lyrics today on this episode, so get ready to clutch those pearls. Now, if you didn't listen to part one, I advise you to do that. I just published it not too long ago. It should be the most recent episode on your feed. Because in that, I walked you through the whole story. I pulled out a lot of ideas in there. Today, we're going to kind of shed some light on those ideas, go a little deeper into all the things I talked to you about. And basically, in part one, I laid out in the book the idea that maybe this is some MKUltra mind-controlled incel killer being groomed. We talked about the people shooting hat, Holden Caulfield, the main character, his obsession with sex, his violent fantasies. We even tied it to some Luigi Mangione stuff. It was a great time. I hope you enjoyed it. So today you're here for part two to wrap it up, and we're going to shed some more light on this. Also, quick note of housekeeping. I got these super soft podcast t-shirts, and I got them in stock. And if you don't have one, are you a real fan? Do you even listen? I'm just kidding. But if you do want a super soft t-shirt, gumroad.com/IsaacW. Gum, like bubblegum, gumroad.com/IsaacW. Links are always in the show notes. You can get yourself a super soft t-shirt. It says these nerds are going to kill us on the back, which if you're paying attention to the news, there's some very powerful nerds, and guess what they're trying to do? All right? Also, you can get some signed books, all kinds of great stuff at the old Gumroad store. So, let's get into today's show. First, let's talk a little bit about the book. Because last time we didn't have enough time. Last time we just walked through the whole book. This book was written basically in the mid-40s in serial form and then novelized in 1951 by J.D. Salinger. Now, the 40s and the 50s were kind of pre-hippie era. This is the beatniks, which if you paid attention to Charles Manson's story, he always said he was a beatnik. He wasn't a hippie. And a lot of those beatnik influences from a lot of, you know, like your Aldous Huxley's and Aleister Crowley's, like that was kind of more of a beatnik thing, right? Of questioning the official status quo and the social constructs. So J.D. Salinger comes along in 51 and writes this book. It turns out to be the most censored book in the United States for 20 years, from the 60s to the 80s, and still challenged to this day. So there's a lot of people. I read in the Patreon comments, a lot of people who said, man, I can't believe I read this book in high school. Why'd they make me read this? And it could be for a variety of reasons, right? And we're going to wrap that up in the conclusion. It could be that it's just a controversial piece of American pop culture. I'll kind of soapbox it in the conclusion, but we'll come back to that. But the major beef of why this book was censored was a variety of things. We got vulgar language, because again, this was written in the 40s, folks. 1951. People didn't talk like this in public. References to sex, blasphemy, because he questions God and hates the disciples. Remember that? Undermining family values, encouraging rebellion. I mean, this is like pre-Elvis time, okay? Promoting drinking, smoking, promiscuity, and even some sexual abuse in there. And the defense of the book is that this is a book written for adults, not kids, which raises the question of why do they have kids in high school read this book? And, you know me, I'm a very sort of liberal guy with this kind of stuff. I'm all for it. Like, if it's adults, go for it, right? But I do kind of draw the line where I'm like, dude, there's a million books you could read. Like, why don't you have them read something else that's a little, you know, because not everyone in high school is equipped to read this stuff and not let it affect them, maybe, right? Like, I was fine with it. So I was telling someone, I was like, I watched A Clockwork Orange when I was like 14, man. I was watching violent stuff, and and I'm 100% fine. I keep getting sinus infections, so maybe that's why. It's God punishing me for watching filth. God, sorry. Okay, so the title, Catcher in the Rye, it actually comes from a poem that's described in the book, but not recited. Exactly. It's called Comin' Throw the Rye by Robert Burns in 1784. So, right? Old-timey. And it's about this field of rye or wheat. And then you also see some interpretations that say it's about a narrow cobblestone lane prone to puddles of water. I don't know. Either way, it's full of sexual references. And I think we go through that later in this research here. Now, the cover shows us a horse. If you look at the cover artwork, it's a scene in the book, at the end of the book, at the merry-go-round, which I talked about connecting to Luigi Mangione in the last episode. But if you look at it, you think, I don't know, it kind of looks like the horse of the apocalypse, right? Which is pretty dark. But it would be the end, because like I argue in the book, in the part one, I think this is a lot about mass murder and suicide of the main character. So it is the end for him. Now, of course, the official version you'll see about this story is that, oh, it's just a book about the loss of childhood innocence and Holden's very scared to lose his innocence. And I'm like, I don't think so. It's because the catcher in the rye in the story is supposed to stop the kids from growing older, but he's kind of killing them, right? He's catching bodies. That's what he says. Because my interpretation of the book was that this is more of American Psycho than anything, which I should have looked up to see if American Psycho was connected to this or influenced by Catcher in the Rye. I bet it was. Because you got Holden, the main character, he's all charged up sexually. He's mad. He's an incel. He's a virgin. And he's got these fantasies of violence. And I argue that he actually did them. And it's a whole veiled story about his murdering of these people. And the last chapter shows him in the psych ward. Because remember, he had that red hat. It was his people shooting hat. And you had all these influences in pop culture of various people conducting murders based on this book's influence, right? We'll talk about Mark David Chapman later on. And recall in the books, in the story, Mr. Antolini, who I argue, and I don't think it's just me, because I was looking for the artwork for the part one, and other people had, I seen a couple articles where people talked about how Mr. Antolini seems to sexually abuse Holden, so not just me. But Mr. Antolini wanted Holden to go see that psychoanalyst, Wilhelm Steckel. We talked about this a little bit in part one, but Steckel was a real psychoanalyst during the writing of the book in the 40s. Big collaborator with Freud, and he studied symbolism in dreams. And he talked about the libido being transformed depending on whatever the person's emotional state is experiencing. And he also studied fetishes, which he called the fetish the unconscious religion in a person's psyche, whatever. People always correct me. I don't remember. I don't know. Psyche or psych? I don't know. I'll say them both. The point is, Antolini abused Holden, right? And then wanted Wilhelm Steckel to unpack this for him. What a dick. He's like, so I'm going to essay you, and then I'm going to have you talk to this therapist who can tell you all about sick fetishes that I've got and clear you up a little bit. Like, that's crazy, right? Crazy work. So J.D. Salinger, let's talk about who he was. First off, he never wanted this put into film. That's why you've never seen a movie for Catcher in the Rye. And every big A-lister tried to make this happen because the book is so, I don't know, controversial, popular, read, whatever. People like Spielberg, Harvey Weinstein, of course, he would want to try to make this a movie. And everybody, all the big names want to portray Holden Caulfield. Tobey Maguire, Jack Nicholson, Marlon Brando, John Cusack, and of course the greatest of all time. The only one that would be acceptable to do this, Leo DiCaprio. But Salinger died in 2010. He was an old dude. And his work is in a trust, and that trust still doesn't allow anyone to make this a film. Which is probably why you can't even find an audible version of this book. Now, I don't know what the copyright time frame is, but I think we're probably coming up on that in 10, 20 years where the copyright will be expired and maybe someone can just do it. But if you follow the history of Disney, they somehow are able to extend the copyrights past their legal time frame for Disney characters. So who knows what happens. But who was J.D. Salinger? Well, first and foremost, he was a counterintelligence agent in the Army. So there's that. And his first battle was D-Day. So lots going on there for this guy, right? And he was actually writing Catcher in the Rye during World War II while he was stationed overseas there. And, you know, fun fact, meanwhile, his girl back in the States, Una O'Neill, turned 18 and married Charlie Chaplin, a man who was at that time in his 50s. I mean, that's pretty strange, right? J.D. Salinger talked about World War II, and he talked about how he saw all these sort of dead bodies, and he said, "You never really get the smell of burning flesh out of your nostrils." Now, what's interesting to me is that I took an anatomy course in college, and they talked about how the olfactory nerves or center or whatever you call it, the olfactory, the nose, the smell thing, is connected to your brain. That's why sometimes certain smells can bring up nostalgic feelings. So for him, I think those two are connected, and I think, oh, this guy's got severe PTSD. He can't get the smell out of his nostrils. I don't think it's like a physical sensation. I think it's a mental sensation, right? And to sort of support that argument, if you look at the studies for PTSD, they'll tell you that after 200 days of war, you go crazy. Well, JD spent 299 days at war, so probably some PTSD through there, right? Also, a lot of this information, there's a documentary that I saw on Amazon about J.D. Salinger. That's where I got most of this information. If you're looking for more, I'm just summating it for you. So after the war, J.D. Salinger wants to go back overseas. And he goes back and he's hunting Nazis and doing some intelligence work. And he ends up marrying one. Sylvia was her name. He claimed they were connected telepathically and that they'd met in dreams. Now, I'm going to guess David Lynch and Mark Frost read Catcher in the Rye. And David Lynch's vision in Twin Peaks of Cooper and Laura meeting in the dreams in the Red Room, I'm going to guess there's some influence there. And, you know, Cooper, he's a strong sender, telepathically connected. JD, so he's writing all these stories, right? And he wrote this story called Elsma about his experience of meeting a girl at the beach. Sounds innocent enough, right? Well, pump the brakes. He was 30 years old. She was 14. He, in the story, he likes her, but knew she was too young and he wanted to kiss her. And instead, he tells her mom that he would marry her someday. Very creepy. A couple of the times J.D. Salinger got burned giving stories to Hollywood or magazines because they'd always change something and it became a real peeve of his. Like, he was real obsessed with it, right? Which is probably why he doesn't want a movie or an audiobook, is because he doesn't like it when other people are interpreting his thing, which is also very Lynchian, right? David Lynch is always talks about, like, you fish for these big ideas and then you commit to that original idea. You do not, like, deviate from it. Which is, you know, a lot of artists sort of embrace that. Someone said that J.D. Salinger writing Catcher in the Rye was kind of like him exorcising demons. Which, again, when you look at it from the perspective of Holden being a mass murderer and having contempt for everybody, like, maybe that was J.D. Salinger, right? Desensitized to murder and war. Could be. And JD was, in fact, very anti-establishment. And he came back to the States and saw America as a shopping center. And America had lost its soul. And he literally said that he saw Holden Caulfield in himself. He said, because after World War II, he came back to America, came back to the States after, you know, a year or two or whatever it was he ended up spending over there. And he said he didn't even recognize America anymore. Which, I know that feeling. I did a short tour in South Korea for a year, and I came back, and I remember it was a mixed feeling. Like, on the one hand, it was like walking into Candyland. You know, you drive down the street, and you see a million fast foods and restaurants and shopping and all the colors and logos. But on the other hand, you're like, wow, this is wild. Like, it does have a weird feel, consumer obsessed feel to it, which is, of course, you know, this is capitalism, this is what we do, right? So I kind of know what he's talking about. I certainly didn't go through what he went through for what it's worth, but anyway, so the editor for the book read it, and he says to JD Salinger, he says, hey, I think this Holden character is crazy, which is my interpretation as well. Oh, and I want to caveat all of this. When I read the book, I went in completely blind. I had never read it before. I never talked to anyone who read it. I interviewed Ryder Lee and Jade Widener about their movie Kubrick's Odyssey 3 a couple months ago. And they make a very strong connection. You got to watch it. You got to watch it on Amazon. Listen to my podcast and to tantalize yourself and then go watch it. They talk about, in fact, let me put a link in the show notes. Link Kubrick's Odyssey 3. Because I want you to listen to that interview if you haven't. And they make a very strong connection of Catcher in the Rye to The Shining, amongst all the other Catcher in the Rye conspiracies. And I, after I interviewed him, I said, man, I got to read this book. I just have to read it. And I read it, didn't consult any studies, any articles, any reviews. I had no idea. And I just jotted all the notes down. I said, this is kind of crazy. And to be honest with you, I've stumbled across a couple articles here and there. I still could be off on a lot of things. I don't know. I still haven't studied what the sort of, I just know the mainstream sort of reactant to it was that this is a coming of age story. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I mean, on one level, sure. On the crazy tinfoil paranoid level, no. But yeah, the editor says, man, I think this Jade, the editor reads the story, tells JD, hey, I think this Holden guy's crazy, which I agree with. And J.D. Salinger starts crying. Because, again, J.D. Salinger identifies as Holden. He's the crazy guy. And I would argue J.D. Salinger, like many, if he was into younger folks, pedophilia, it was probably because he was maybe a victim of one. Like, maybe he had a Mr. Antiloni who abused him, right? It's this cycle. So JD gets the book done, finally publishes in 1951. It resonates immediately with everyone. Kids are like, oh, wow, I got a story that explains how I feel. Like, I'm so full of resentment and angst. And everyone carries it around with them. On the documentary, John Cusack talks about how it felt cool to carry this book around with you, right? And that's a bit of the rationale for why all these people have this book on them and why they always talked about it. It was just a major thing, and I think it tapped into something that maybe hadn't been tapped into before, right? And ever since then, it devolved into, you know, I was a teenager watching Marilyn Manson videos and stuff, right? It's kind of ramping up the angst of the teenagers, which I don't know if is healthy exactly. Anyway, so J.D. Salinger becomes a celebrity instantly. He hates it. He thinks people should only know the artist through his work, and that is it, which is very Kubrickian, all right? So JD's like, I'm out of here. He ends up leaving the city. He goes to Cornish, New Hampshire, and not because he was necessarily a hermit or a recluse. Like, a lot of people that knew him are like, no, he was very outgoing. He just didn't like the fame. And so he moves up to Cornish, New Hampshire. He continues writing. He didn't publish a ton of books, by the way, over his lifetime, but he wrote this thing called Nine Stories. It's a bunch of short stories. And most of them were actually written prior to Catcher in the Rye. He just published them later. And there's themes of suicide in those stories and, you know, people getting out of the world, as he kind of describes it. And JD ends up getting with that young girl from the beach, the 14-year-old. And she tried to kiss him and get intimate, but for whatever reason, that turned him off. He ends up dumping her because she was in the way of his work, because he was obsessed with work. And that sounds very sort of incel behavior, I guess. I don't know. How do incels act? I have no idea. But again, remember, he identifies as Holden Caulfield. So then he meets another woman named Claire Douglas, and they end up getting married. And they have kids. But he is spending so much time out, and he's got a shed in his backyard, and he's just writing 24/7, and Claire's taking care of the kids, and he's completely absent. So she's like, man, F this guy. And they split up in 1967. Then he dates a woman named Joyce Maynard. And again, there's a 40-year age gap between these two when they hook up. Now, she was legal, barely. But she eventually breaks it off with him. And he's kind of a dick, is kind of the idea here. And she writes a book about it, and it's a whole thing. And while they were together, he led her into his spirituality, and he was into meditation. He meditated every day. And in he's got stories called the Franny and Zooey stories. And apparently, I didn't read them. He talks about his spirituality because he was interested in Zen Buddhism and Hinduism and Eastern Orthodox Christianity, which I was like, that's pretty fascinating because like those are the things I'm interested in. If you forced me to pick a religion or belief or whatever, like it would be a blend of, you know, Buddhism and Christianity that resonates. Obviously, I identify Greek Orthodox, so like that's my religion, to be clear. But there's like Buddhist elements and meditation that really helps a ton as a tool, not as a religion, just to be clear. So he gets married in 1988 to a different woman named Colleen O'Neill and stays with her till 2010 when he dies in New Hampshire. So he must have figured out a way to be a better spouse, I guess. And after his death, his family trust claimed that they were going to release 5 more books about the characters that he had written about, the Glass family, Holden Caulfield, and a few others, right? And one of those stories is about being in counterintelligence. Because again, we can't forget and let go of the idea that this guy was an intelligence agent, which, granted, I know that's like a boogeyman in the conspiracy world. I'm not saying just because you're into intelligence, you're Illuminati confirm, right? It's like this. It's like not all intelligence agents are Illuminati confirm, but all Illuminati confirms are intelligence agents, right? You get that? And maybe it's just because like they're the ones with the secrets. Like it could be just as simple as that, right? Like I worked munitions and ordnance. They're not giving me no secrets about. about aliens and stuff like that. Fun fact, Holden had a son named Matt, and Matt was in the movies. He was in the 1990 film Captain America, which I haven't seen yet, but I'm very interested. Because, you know, growing up back in the day, I was obsessed with comic books, and the movies back then for comic book nerds was like, they were terrible. The best thing you had to watch back in the 80s and 90s was the Batman series from the 60s. That was the best. Because, like, the Spider-Man movie was trash. I'm going to guess the Captain America movie was trash. The Batman movies were great. They were great from the jump. That was kind of the first one that was able to pull it off. Yeah, so for whatever reason, Batman translates the best, huh? Is the moral of that story. Okay, so that was J.D. Salinger. Mix of inappropriate relationship ages, dark themes, PTSD, intelligence, and so on. Now, let's revisit Clockwork Shining, Kubrick's Odyssey 3. The reason that they connect so much of Kubrick's The Shining into Catcher in the Rye is because Wendy is reading Catcher in the Rye in the kitchen at the beginning of the movie when she's sitting with Danny. And again, if you refer back to I did a show July of 2024 about the date July 16th because a bunch of ritual type events line up with this date. Why? I had some ideas that I presented on that show. Go listen to it. Links in the show notes, as always. Not as always. For this episode, I'll put them in the show notes. We had the Trinity test in 1945. You had Apollo 11 in 68 or 69. And then you had Eyes Wide Shut. And, you know, the Trinity atomic bomb allegedly opened up the gateway for the UFOs. Apollo 11, of course, the big fake moon landing, a big ritualistic event. And then Eyes Wide Shut, a massive sort of ritual, illuminate, confirm movie. And it connects into a wide breadth of conspiracies. The Manhattan Project, James Shelby Donard's synchromysticism of the JFK assassination with King Kill 33, UFOs, Twin Peaks, Wizard of Oz. I mean, all kinds of stuff, right? And sex magic. And if you try to make sense of it, say, why 716? Well, I mean, I'm not much of a gematria nerd because I feel like gematria nerds find any excuse to connect numbers into what they want you to believe. But for this instance, I consider it, right? Because 716 is like 7 for the month, and then 16, 1 plus 6 equals 7. So you got 7-7. And 77 is the number that represents spiritual awakening, enlightenment, and connection to the divine. Well, Catcher in the Rye released on July 16th. And then you have all this sort of Robert Bardot kills Rebecca Schaefer. She was an actress and a model. And he was obsessed with a bunch of pop celebrities. Tiffany, Debbie Gibson, Madonna. Oh, I mean, every death's a tragedy, but I mean, come on. Oh, what? And then, you know, I love Madonna. My Kabbalah queen. And then John Hinckley tried to assassinate Reagan. He had the book in his hotel room. And then you got Mark David Chapman murdering John Lennon, who he identified as Holden Caulfield. And there's a massive UFO subplot that I want to get into with him in case you didn't catch it. If you haven't read my book, The Dark Path, it's the magnum opus. It's the best book I've written. It covers everything from start to finish. And it's very prophetic in a million ways. Okay. It's my most read book. It's my most popular. And it's the one I recommend to everyone if they're trying to read one of my 9 books, okay? And if you want a free ebook copy, well, free, I guess, with the asterisk, if you sign up to my patreon.com/IlluminatiWatcher or the IlluminatiWatcher.com VIP section, if you know how to copy and paste an RSS, you could save a few bucks. I give you the ebook for free, along with Kubrick's Code, something I talk about all the time. So you get 2 free books. I mean, can you believe it? For $5. As of right now, inflation, I got to raise those prices, though, so get ready for that. I don't know. I'll try to keep it $5. I know times are tough for everybody. All right, so I'm going to read you from The Dark Path, so you don't even have to do any of that, okay? What a guy. Another theory is that Mark David Chapman was playing a role in the battle between extraterrestrials. The claim is that Chapman was visited by aliens from a different tribe that were of the malevolent variety. That means bad. They wanted him to take Lenin out to shut down his peaceful movement. Lenin's message of peace and unity was believed to have been channeled from the benevolent, that's good, the benevolent faction of aliens. Always have to think it through, that's why I say it. Not for you, it's because I'm an idiot. Which supports the theory that the Beatles were all being used as conduits for being from another dimension. Described by Lenin in 1988, People magazine, quote, I felt like a hollow temple filled with many spirits, each one passing through me, each one inhabiting me for a little time and then leaving me to be replaced by another. Sounds like possession to me. As wild as this theory sounds, John Lennon himself claimed to have been abducted by aliens as a child. In an interview with one of Lennon's former lovers, May Pang, revealed his belief in life-altering alien contact. Lennon held a belief that aliens would have the ability to bridge humanity under some new umbrella of thought, of truth, that the world governments did not want us to become aware of. John thought that the governments of the world were covering up the truth about UFOs. He said, if the masses started to accept UFOs, it would profoundly affect their attitude toward life, politics, everything. It would threaten the status quo. Spiritually, Lenin believed in the same grand creator of Freemasonry or cosmic consciousness of the New Agers. He laid it out like this, quote, Christ, Buddha, Krishna, Muhammad were all messengers of the Supreme Being. They were all saying basically the same thing, laying down the laws of the universe in language appropriate to their culture. The trick is to make all this subconscious knowledge conscious. The idea that Chapman was possessed by demonic aliens is not that far of a stretch. His own story reveals he was dabbling with demonic forces and made contact with something of an evil nature if we read an excerpt from People magazine in 1987. Before he left for Fort Chaffee that August, he began seriously dating Jessica Blankenship, a friend from the fundamentalist prayer groups. In one such group, led by a Decatur psychologist, Chapman and Jessica had their first experiences with some of the rarer, more dramatic forms of charismatic Christianity, the laying on of hands, miraculous healing, speaking in tongues, the gift of prophecy, and the deliverance from demons. At times, I would be on my back, and five or six people would be laying on hands, Chapman recalled years later. At other times, there would be manifestations of demonic power. I remember one man barking like a dog and then assuming a karate position. We talked about demons more than we did about Jesus. He was finished praying to God for deliverance, but his loss of faith did not extend to the powers of darkness. I began to pray to Satan, he told John Marks's co-counsel David Suggs, after months of refusing to talk about what he referred to as the spiritual matters relevant to John Lennon's murder. I said, just make me crazy. I want to be psycho. I don't want to have to take this. It wasn't like I'd get down on my knees. It was like I'd be walking down the street or just doing what I was doing, and I'd say, you know, I want to be crazy. I wanted to be totally mad, out of touch with the world. While most would argue that Chapman was just plain crazy, he in fact had several assessments confirming this, he insisted otherwise. The pastor of his church, Reverend Charles McGowan, was the first to visit Chapman in prison. He spoke of the mental illness of Chapman as something much darker in nature. Quote, there is a dimension to this case that the secular psychiatric world would never understand. I believe there was a demonic power at work. Could it be that Chapman was under the influence of demonic forces? Were these entities actually extraterrestrials? I believe it to be possible. The idea that aliens exist is plausible, but as we'll reveal elsewhere in this book, it may be that they are demonic forces from another dimension. Some call them fallen angels, and I find it quite possible since there are points of light and dark to be found in this world. Just like the occultists who practice magic believe, there are forces of white and black magic. We are capable of contacting either one. I wrote that in 2017, I think. Back when it was crazy to talk about aliens, you know? Simpler times. All right, final topic we got to cover. Joe Atwill. He was on Tinfoil Hat talking about Catcher in the Rye not too long ago. A couple years ago, maybe. And he claims that Catcher in the Rye is about a warning to Freemasons about breaking the oath. And that's why Mark David Chapman was reading the book. It's a signal to other Masons. He was sending out a warning to the other Masons, apparently. You know, you can't talk about what's really going on. And apparently John Lennon told Playboy magazine he didn't want to be a Mason anymore, but he's in there for life. And I couldn't validate that personally. I'm not saying Joe's making that up. I'm just saying I couldn't verify it. I couldn't find a online copy of the interview. Apparently, they interviewed him in 1980 over the course of several days, but they didn't publish all of it. So, I don't know. It gets into a little dicey territory there. And I'm not a big enough Beatles geek to know the whole story. But if you read Joe Atwill's, go to his full article on Post Flaviana. He talks about this thing, the Freemason and the Rye theory. And if you recall, the beginning of the story, there's that 28-day period where he's studying Egyptian. And I talked about how the halfway point is the 14th day in, which is November 18th, day 322. Remember? Well, he is referring to that whole period. I wonder if he knows that. Someone better reach out to Joe and tell him, hey, Isaac found the midpoint is 322. Does that matter? I don't know. Well, he's saying that the 28-day period of studying Egyptian is the same as Freemasonry. There's a 28-day minimum period between conference of degrees. And there's all this Egyptian mythology in their studies. And I read that the process starts, that 28-day period starts when your petition is read in the lodge. Okay. But anyway, there's this 28-day period. So to get from entered apprentice to fellow craft, the second degree, that's kind of what you see in the book. And then he talks about how by the end of the book, Holden is actually a third degree, a master mason, which is the highest degree in standard Freemasonry, or the Blue Lodge Freemasonry, because it only has 3 degrees. And once you hit master mason, you're permitted to enter the Holy of Holies to learn the ultimate secret. And Robert Burns describes Freemason as the Sons of Light. And they're sworn to implement the apocalypse on all the non-Freemasons, and they're going to kill everyone exposed to the plans. Now, that arguably is what Holden is doing. He's mass murdering as a sort of, I don't know, obsession with the Freemason idea of killing the non-Freemasons. Now, the entered apprentice degree is, you know, I had to dig into some of these things, is about learning some of the secrets, the language of Freemasonry. And the fellow craft is more advanced. It's more into the enlightenment and wisdom stuff. It says this degree represents the member reaching manhood, which is interesting because that's kind of what the story is about, right? It's about Holden maturing and reaching adulthood and becoming a man. And all the Joe says all the advisors throughout the story Holden seeks are giving him clues to initiate him. The one person says that life is a game with rules, which is actually pretty accurate, right? But recall The Game, the Michael Douglas movie. I'll put a link in the show notes. July of 2020, if you're on the supporter feed, scroll back to July 2020. We did a whole analysis on The Game because Michael Douglas, he is born into this sort of waspy family. He's an investment banker, total jerk, and his brother gets him into The Game, which is this entertainment and this profound life experience. And what follows is basically an initiation to force one to question the nature of reality, face death, and become reborn like the Freemasons. He has to follow all the rules, right? Life is a game with rules. That's what they say in Catcher in the Rye. And the movie's got Freemason symbolism. I don't want to spoil anything. Go check out my... You got a lot to check out, a lot of shows to catch up on if you haven't. So the idea that Joe Atwell puts forward is that Holden has previously failed to get through initiation. That's what all the failings at the prep schools had been before this one. You know, I kept getting kicked out of schools. But nonetheless, he makes it through, including the facing of one's own death, right? There's a scene where Holden says something about feeling like he's dead. And this is the third degree, the Master Mason degree, which you imitate the death of Hiram Abiff. Then there's the scene at the end where the two brothers escort Holden into the museum, and you got all the Egyptian stuff, right? And he ends up going into this tomb alone. And this is where, like, the mummies exhibit is, I talked about in part one, where Holden's taking them down this spooky hallway, and then the kids get scared and they run away. In the book, he said, to get to where the mummies are, you had to go down this very narrow sort of hall with stones on the side that they'd taken right out of the Pharaoh's tomb and all. It was pretty spooky, and you could tell the two hotshots I was with weren't enjoying it too much. They stuck close as hell to me, and the one that didn't talk at all practically was holding my sleeve. Let's go, he said to his brother. I seen him already. Come on, hey. He turned around and beat it. I was the only one left in the tomb then. I sort of liked it in a way. It was so nice and peaceful. And that could be the Chamber of Reflection in Freemasonry. It's like a little tomb where there's a skull and the initiate is to contemplate death. Now, Joe Atwell talks about the poem, and this is where things get real interesting. And the real title is not Catcher in the Rye, but Fucker in the Rye. Crazy. This is what Joe says. Where Caulfield heard catch, the child must have been singing fuck. Salinger's real title is therefore Fucker in the Rye, and this describes Caulfield's revelation in the Freemason's Holy of Holies given below. In other words, that's the deepest secret of Freemasonry. It's fuck you, which appears to be the apocalypse to non-Freemasons and death to members that are traitors to the organization. Because you remember at the end of the story that we talked about in part one, Holden kept seeing this word fuck you carved in all the walls. Remember that? And the museum that he's in represents the Freemasonic Holy of Holies, which is why he doesn't go in earlier in the book. He's not initiated to get in there yet. And in the book, there's a reference to a guy named Al Pike, like Albert Pike. I didn't catch that when I read it. A friend, Carl Luce, talks about understanding patterns, and Luce also means light, like Lucifer. And there's lots of talks about ducks in the story. And it could be a reference to shooting ducks, like shooting the sheep. Throughout the book, Holden keeps saying stuff that, you know, he's like, that kills me. Right? And this is more of the death stuff. And Holden goes home and he sees his sister Phoebe journaling with this cryptic writing that is symbolically is a Freemasonic interpretation of the Book of Revelation and the end times. Oh, it's pretty crazy. If you read his whole Freemason in the Rye, he explains it much deeper. Mr. Antolini initiates Holden into the final state, into that Master Mason degree. That's the sexual abuse. In the book, he says, I woke up all of a sudden. I don't know what time it was or anything, but I woke up. I felt something on my head, some guy's hand. Boy, it really scared the hell out of me. What it was Mr. Antolini's hand. What he was doing, he was sitting on the floor right next to the couch in the dark and all, and he was sort of petting me or patting me on the goddamn head. Boy, I'll bet I jumped about 1,000 feet. Now, and also, this is where things get a little more insidious. If you recall, in the book, Holden talks about leaving town to go to Colorado to work on a ranch. And there's rumors of a powerful secret society that exists in Denver, in Colorado. It's in chapter 21 when he's talking to his sister Phoebe. He says, nobody's going to kill me. Use your head. In the first place, I'm going away. What I may do, I may get a job on a ranch or something for a while. I know this guy whose grandfather's got a ranch in Colorado. I may get a job out there. I'll keep in touch with you when I'm gone if I go. We're almost done, folks. Hang in there. And if you follow the end of the story to sort of get back into that apocalypse talk, at the story's end, Caulfield now has the ultimate knowledge. And at the same time, this is from Joe Atwill's. I'm reading from Joe Atwill's Freemason in the Rye. Okay. At the story's end, Caulfield now has the ultimate knowledge because he's the Master Mason, right? And at the same time, he has resigned himself to his role and his place in life as a Freemason. He no longer wishes to catch the children. Rather, he is the fucker in the rye who lets them fall. He is wearing his shooting hat and is presumably now shooting the bull. That is Christianity. Deliriously happy as he is soaked by falling rain. The horses on the merry-go-round symbolize the four horsemen who ride at the apocalypse. The smoke in your eyes is the smoke from Caulfield's symbolic rifle. Or is it a real rifle? Caulfield's sanity and his grip on reality seem fragile. Perhaps his report is a sugarcoating of a real mass murder event. In closing, Caulfield reminds us, as he told us in the beginning, that he's been sent off to some sort of rehabilitation camp on the West Coast, where he's being subjected to psychoanalysis, or mind control before he will go on for more schooling. And Joe Atwill has more, believe it or not. If you want to go deeper into this, it's called Pedophile in the Rye, and he sums up a conspiracy about the book and how it ties into culture creation. He says, we asked the reader to consider whether Salinger created the Catcher in the Rye as part of this project. Culture moves slowly, and the book seems to have been intended to operate as a precursor to the more destructive ideas about sex, drugs, and music that would follow. The book helped to, among other things, began the process of isolating teenagers from their parents in order to break down the family structure. The trend started by Holden Caulfield's lonely teenage angst would end up in Woodstock with drugged-out baby boomers experiencing casual sex in the mud while their rock idols, many of whom were the children of military intelligence, played music designed to diminish their intellect. So, you know, shots fired from Joe Atwill. My goodness. He lays down a pretty good argument, though. I got to hand it to him. And again, you can catch his full, I don't know if they're books necessarily, but his writings about this on his website. Where is it? Post Flaviana is where you can find the full articles if you want to dig deeper into it. And one of the ideas, in conclusion, the book, it's alleged to be a trigger mechanism for MKUltra mind control for murderers. And in the book, it's argued that the people shooting hat, which is a red hat, interesting, you could tweak that today, but we're going to keep it, it could be a fez, right? And the fez aligns with Freemasonry, which I've got a Gravity Falls analysis I worked on years ago, and I'm like 3/4 through every episode of Gravity Falls. And it's a major part of that. And I found a link to Epstein in Gravity Falls. I mean, I got all kinds of stuff. I just got to sit down and finish it. But, and so stay subscribed to my show, folks. I'm going to give you a Gravity Falls deep dive one of these years, one of these days. Who knows when it happens? I really follow my sort of intuition when it comes to making shows. Like sometimes I'll be really into a subject and I just dive in, and then other times I kind of float around and like, okay, let me get some stuff done. So who knows? But it ties into the Fez and the Shriners. It's tied into Freemasonry. And because one of the characters in Gravity Falls wears one all the time, okay? So Holden's aligned with the Freemasons, and he is allowed to break any of the crimes he wants for the greater good, the great work of the Freemasons. So he wears this hat, and he's killing kids at the end. He's got the moral authority. Very Sandy Hook. Someone in the Patreon comments said that, I guess Adam Lanza said something about protecting kids when he was shooting them. I couldn't find that. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I casually quickly looked and I didn't see it. So whoever said that, please drop a link if you got one. It is interesting though, huh? And then, you know, there's just so much going on in this book. It's hard to ignore it and say that, oh, there's absolutely nothing there. And you could come out of this with two viewpoints, which is, I kind of go between the two. On the one hand, if you take it from the rational point of view, non-conspiratorial, you could just argue that, look, this was an influential book in the 50s and 60s. It was even a radical book because it wasn't just sunshine and rainbows and the Hardy Boys. It tapped into the angst of teenagers all over the world that apparently nothing had done before. And the support for why this is so influential, and you see it with all these sort of pop culture moments and murders and things, it's hard to understand today with our frame of reference because we're majorly desensitized. I grew up, and this was just normal pop culture, this angst, rebellion sort of vibe. And this kind of book wouldn't even hit the radar today. So it's hard to be in that frame of reference of the 40s, 50s, 60s. So we look at this book and we say, well, you know, it's in all these movies and murders and it's so influential. It's got to be brainwashing people, right? But in reality, maybe it was just a radical, influential book back then. You know, and I would compare it, if I was forced to compare it, I would say, well, look at in 2020, conspiracy theories, they were too radical. They were getting, we all got censored a ton. I'm still getting censored to this day. And all the things we were talking about 2020 and before, if you're an OG, you've been around, you know, I've been doing this since 2011. A lot of these conspiracies are coming true. The Great Reset, the aliens, the transhumanism, and the billionaires shoving us into the digital matrix. And we're sliding into it. I mean, it's plain as day. I'll do a show about that one of these days. And you could just argue from a rational point of view that, like, this was just influential. On the other hand, if you put on that tinfoil hat, which I know you do, you got this author who was military intelligence around the time of MKUltra in the 50s when the CIA was doing this stuff, planted a ton of subtle-ish, sort of not-so-subtle references to incel murderers and sex perversion and pedophilia and sex abuse and mass murdering. And the author himself, who identified as Holden, kind of had these strange pedo vibes and antisocial behaviors. And then you got all these actual murders that happen, right? People actually catching bodies influenced by this book. in their hands. And it ties into a lot of real MKUltra mind control murderer conspiracies like Project Chaos that Tom O'Neill wrote about with Charles Manson. So I'd argue that there is something real insidious beneath the surface. But obviously it's up to you, right? I just thought it was a very interesting study, and if you made it this far into the two-parter, thank you for listening. Thanks for sticking with it. I appreciate that. Again, I'll put links in the show notes for some other shows that we talked about. If you're on the supporter feeds, you're going to have to scroll back on the app. I'm sorry. That's just kind of the way it goes. Again, I got some super soft t-shirts. I haven't sold one in a while. I'm like, what happened? You guys don't like these shirts no more? Do you hate me? What's going on? Buy a shirt. Gumroad.com/IsaacW. Link in the show notes as always. Till next time, stay positive.